Now we continue our study of James chapter 3, and we're ready to start verse 3. The subject, though, of course, begins before that. In verses 1 and 2, he says, "My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For many things we offend all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body." So we went through that in our study, but he established the context where he's teaching us about the tongue, even though he didn't use that word there in those two verses. But that is the subject, as we use our tongues to teach. So when he starts off with the application or the subject of teaching, I mean, that involves the use of our tongues, which he ties into verse 2, giving the reason why we need to be very careful before we agree to use our tongues in that way to be a teacher. Because if we do so in a manner that causes others to trip, which is the meaning of that word there, offend, then we would face the greater condemnation in the judgment. And then he says, because we all do in many things offend, cause others to trip. And when we look at any one of us, any and every one of us can go back through looking back at ourselves over the course of time, going back to the past, and there's as he's teaching us the point there in verse 2, when we are able to not do that, not to cause others to trip with our words, at that point he says we are a complete man and able also to bridle the whole body. And so we really were looking in a lot of detail at that point, which shows us what our most difficult job is. And if we are looking back at ourselves, examining ourselves now where we are at the present, but I don't think we have to go very far back to see a lot of things that where we've had problems that it involved our tongues in a lot of those ways or times, maybe most of it, but that it's very true. And this is why the Lord tells us that if we are not causing anyone to trip with the words that we use, and that's why the word offend there doesn't mean if somebody doesn't like what we say. I mean, that's how people look at that or use the word offend nowadays. So if you don't like what somebody says or something, then you can claim to be offended, and that means automatically it's the fault of the person and whatever it was they said that you don't like. But that's not what the Lord is saying there. So if somebody doesn't like what we say, does that mean we're in the wrong? Well, did anybody not like what Jesus? Any of the things that Jesus said? did he say anything wrong? No. Now, was he causing others to trip by his words? No. Now, did they trip because of their unbelief at what he said? Yes, but that was not because Christ was at any fault in what he said or how he said it. I mean, as we were studying Sunday, I mean, Jesus was sent from the Father. He was a prophet, and he only spoke the Father's words. But people didn't like it. And so if we are following Christ and we are teaching his words like we should, then is there any chance that there's going to be anybody that doesn't like something we say? Well, yes, that's why we're going to suffer persecution. So just because somebody gets upset at something that we say, I mean, that may be, we may have said the right thing in the right way, but they just don't like the Lord's truth. That may be the cause, in which case we haven't done wrong. The problem in that case would be the person who won't listen to the Lord. But we might want to just conclude that every time that somebody doesn't like something we say, well, it's got to be their fault. That would be easy to do. But then we have to look at ourselves, examine ourselves. If we are causing somebody to actually trip, spiritually trip, which is the exact same word as we pointed out before, back in chapter 2, when he was talking about God's word and his commandments, that in verse 10 of chapter 2, if we offend in one point, we're guilty of all. If we trip in one point of what? Of God's law. So that's what he's talking about. So if we're causing someone to disobey a commandment of God by the words that we use or the way that we use those words, well, that's why if we're in the position of a teacher and if we're teaching error or teaching the truth in a manner that is going to cause someone else to disobey the Lord, then we'll be answering to God in judgment for that. But if we are able in every aspect of our lives, whether we're in the role of a teacher or in every situation, if we are not causing anyone to do any wrong, we're doing no damage spiritually to anyone by the use of our tongues, then what does he say we are at that point? That is the measure of somebody who's spiritually complete. Well, as we studied with this and last time we were in there, I mean, where do our words come from? From the abundance of what? Our heart, the mouth speaks. So for our mouth to only, for there only to be good treasure for us to bring forth good things, only good things through our mouths, well, then how much evil could be there? If there's any amount of evil there, is that going to come out of our mouths? Is our tongue going to be showing that, revealing that evil that's in our hearts, if there's even some? Well, yes, it will. So for us to have grown spiritually and have our hearts formed to the point where there's no evil treasure to be drawing upon to bring out evil from our tongues, but only good formed there, so only good is coming out of our mouths, then what kind of a heart is that? That's a complete heart. And so in that case, that kind of heart, not only is that the source of our words, but it's the source of everything else we do. And so if we have only good in our hearts and we are complete spiritually there, that's going to be demonstrated not by our words, but also if we're able to control what we're our tongues, then what does he say we're able to do also? He says, if you can, and back in chapter 1, as we pointed out in verse 26, if we don't bridle our tongues, then what does he say about our religion? It's vain if we don't bridle our tongues. But yet he's describing bridling our tongues here, and he says if we're bridling our tongues, we're able to bridle the whole body. So which member is the most difficult one to bridle? If the Lord says if you can bridle this one, you're going to be able to bridle everything. I mean, that is the definition right there for us of what our most difficult task is. I'm not going to ask anybody to do this right now, but if I were to ask, well, raise your hand if you think, no, controlling the tongue, easy. It's all the other stuff that's hard. I don't think anybody that's being honest at all, looking in the mirror as he teaches us to do in chapter 1 of this book, we wouldn't be able to say that at all. We know that is a very difficult job, and that's what he's going to go on to describe and using a number of different analogies or metaphors coming up here in the coming verses as we go forward now into chapter 3. So verse 3, to illustrate this point, he says, "Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body." So there's that principle that he's using in that application to further teach the point that he just made. But he says there, behold, and it's kind of interesting that that word, it's I do is the Greek word there. It means lo. But it's at not only the beginning of verse 3, but what's the first word of verse 4? And what's the first word of the second sentence to start the second half of verse 5? He uses that word in three consecutive verses. So he wants us to behold this, doesn't he? He keeps saying, lo. I mean, look at this. It's for us to consider. So this is an important subject, obviously, just even looking at the words that the Lord is using to bring our attention to it. So he says, behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths. Now that particular word, when he says we, it's kind of interesting. He says put. I'm not a horse guy. I mean, I'm a city boy, so I've ridden a horse once in my life when it was out in Texas. Where what better place to ride a horse if you can only do it one time in your life? But anyway, I got on the horse out in Texas for about an hour, and I couldn't walk for the next 4 days. I remember that very well. I mean, I have never ever been as sore in my legs as I was for days after spending about an hour on the back of a horse. So that was my one foray into that. But anyway, I'm not an expert on horses, and I sure was not the one that saddled that thing up. Or, in fact, I would dispute personally. I might at least the experience. It didn't feel like what he's describing there about the horse. It had a bit in its mouth, but that part about its whole body turning about, and I know it wasn't the horse's fault. It was my fault. I didn't know how to steer it. No brake pedals, no gas pedal, no steering wheel. It was just a mess. But anyway, he's using that word to put a bit in the mouth. I thought it was interesting just looking the word up. That's balo. That's the word to throw. I know some people in here have done that. So do you throw it in there? That's probably a good way to do it, to not get bitten, perhaps. I don't know. But anyway, that's the word that he uses for putting the bit in the horse's mouth. And that word bit there, kalanos is the word that he uses for that, which is also the same word that he used in verse 2 when he said that we're able to bridle the whole body. So he's using the word from verse 2 into verse 3, because when he talks about bridling the body, I mean, that right there, using that word, it already has that connotation of what you do with a horse to control it, right? So then he goes straight to that analogy then in the next verse here in verse 3. And it's kind of interesting, that same word, just for your notes, it's translated bridles in Revelation 14 and verse 20. When it talks about the depth of the blood that comes from the wine press of the wrath, which is the word thumos in that chapter, about from God, and how long the river of blood that's up to the horse's bridles. So we do not want to partake of the Lord's thumos, but that's a word that he uses in measurement of that, of the height or the depth of that blood in Revelation 14:20. So this is a common word for the horse's bridle. But here it says he put the bits, and it's the bridle. I mean, so the reins, I think, are connected to that, right? So that's there, put in the horse's mouth. And with the point with that here, that is put there that the horse might do what? He says that might obey us. You know what word that is there? I think this is interesting too. Yeah, it's the root word of faith. This is that particular word. It's patho, which is the basis of the word for pistis, which is the word for faith. It's translated believe a number of times, but it is the word that means to convince by argument. So when it says you put the bit in the horse's mouth that they may obey us, well, it's actually that they may be convinced by argument. Now, what's the argument here in verse 3? Is what? Yeah. The bit's put there because if they resist and try to go a different way, if they don't follow that direction, it's going to be uncomfortable, isn't it? So the argument there is the discomfort. The bit is the basis of the argument. It's to convince the horse to go. So it's kind of interesting the way the word, the choice that he uses there. So if you are riding a horse and you're using the bridle and the reins and everything, so you're trying to convince the horse with that, a very good argument to go the way that you're signaling that the horse is supposed to go. They're going to follow that. And they're going to follow that to the point that a person using that can turn about their whole body. And we all know, there's when we look at ourselves compared to certain animals, we can feel pretty big. If you've got a cat or something like that, we're a lot bigger than, like the house cats. I'm not talking about those ones in Africa and whatnot, but the house cats, we're a lot bigger than they are. We're not intimidated by their size. But what about a horse? We're outmatched big time there. The horses are, how much does a full-grown horse weigh? They weigh a ton or more. A couple of tons. Yeah, those are the big ones. They have the huge feet and all that. They're 10 times or more what our mass is. With the height and that's when they're on all fours. When they raise up, they're way, way bigger than we are. And if what happens if a horse is if it's just being wild, if it's untamed or unbridled, and you were in the way of that, what's going to happen? Can a horse trample a man? Certainly, they can. Here we are, much smaller than. And you go back to the book of Job when he describes, when God describes how he made those animals. They're magnificent. They really are. And God's given an understanding to them, put a type of heart in them. When he's describing in Job, they'll go right into battle when a man. It's not just turning the whole body. A person can take a horse into the heat of battle with all of the weapons and the fury and all of that. Will the horse go there? They will. They will. God's equipped them with. There's a courage in there that God has given to them and an understanding. But He's designed them to follow the direction of man. And they'll do that. But here we are controlling such a large animal, but with what kind of a device? That's the point of this. Here's this giant horse with that massive body, and it's going to be controlled and turned, of course, by the person that's using it. But it's being convinced by the argument of that bit in the mouth. That if they go the other way, it's going to be very uncomfortable. It's going to be painful, and so that's the analogy that the Lord is giving here about our tongues and the power that's there. And we spent virtually an entire lesson a few weeks ago, looking at going through a lot of Proverbs about that and really looking at the power that is there in the tongue. Well, this is illustrating that when he says, here's what we do with a horse and control the entire body of a horse with this little bit. Well, what's our tongue like? And, I mean, how much of us is controlled by that little tongue that's in our mouths? That's what he's talking about there. So he's using that illustration that should really get our attention to think about the great power that is there in the tongue and the job that we have to bring that under control. But that word that he uses there, patho, to convince by argument, this is a good one to remember where that word is used, because this is the word that is the basis for faith. Belief is at the heart of it, is having that, being convinced. Being convinced by argument. Now, just in general, being convinced by argument, does that mean that every convincing or every persuasion is by a good argument or a right one? No, do we have to discern between what are the good arguments and the bad ones as concerning what we should be convinced by? Does the devil have arguments? Now, we use argument when we're talking like as a fight. We get in an argument with somebody. We're getting in a verbal fight with them. But when this is talking about an argument that's more like what we, when we think of like a legal argument or an argument put forth in a debate, we recognize the word then not as something that's necessarily a bad thing, like there's a fight going on, although in the sense when you have competing arguments, there's going to be a fight within us. But the devil has his arguments that he uses, the points that he makes to try to convince us of things. Well, does the Lord have his arguments that are here contained in his word to try to convince us? Yes. Now, therein is the division between truth and error. The devil is the father of what? So he's got all of those arguments that are all lies. Now, well, if it's a lie, that's not very persuasive. That's not going to convince anybody. what do we know? He's got some... Are his lies persuasive? And by the way, that word, persuade, that this word, patho, is very... probably most commonly translated persuaded in the New Testament. A few times it's translated believe, or a couple of other things, but by and large it's translated persuaded. Well, if you're what's the difference between being convinced and persuaded? I really don't distinguish a difference there, but I mean it's not a bad translation to put that word as persuade, because I mean to be convinced or persuaded, I mean that really is very, very close, if not identical. But that's how it's translated usually. But the Lord is trying to persuade us with his truth, which he's making his arguments to convince or persuade us in something. Well, the devil's got all the counter arguments, all of his lies, and he can be very persuasive with his lies. When the multitude, the leaders of the Jews wanted Jesus crucified, they had quite a task there. Now, of course, the reason their task, difficult though it was going to be successful was because it was the Father's will that Jesus go to the cross. Otherwise, all of their efforts would have been in vain. But the way the situation was working, well, the Jews had to convince Pilate to have Jesus delivered to be crucified, where Pilate understood that he was not worthy of any such thing. Now, the big problem that the leaders of the Jews had had for a long time was the difference between what they understood and believed versus the people. Did they really have the people on their side as far as the truth was concerned? Over and over again, they did not. Which is why when in that last week of Jesus' life, when they were working so hard to have him delivered to be killed, and they ended up paying Judas to betray him. But I mean, if they betrayed him into their hands, if they had all the people against them, how successful would they have been? That very week when Jesus was in the temple, and they said, "By what authority do you do these things?" And he said he would answer their question concerning by what authority he did that. If they would answer his question, the baptism of John, was it from heaven or was it of men? Now, it had to be one or the other, right? I mean, there's that's that situation, the law of the excluded middle. I mean, there's no middle ground. There's no alternative. John preached what he preached, and it included baptism. Well, John was either a true prophet or a false prophet. I mean, it can't be neither one, and there can't be a third choice there. What he was saying was either true or false. So the baptism of John, it was either from heaven or it was of men. If it's of men, then where was it from? The devil. I mean, it was either from God or the devil. That's it. So which was it? Now, what did they actually believe, those Jewish leaders that were questioning Jesus then? If they were going to be honest, they were going to say it was of men. I don't know if the Sadducees, did they even believe in the devil? Don't think so. But they didn't believe it was, well, they didn't believe in heaven, did they? They weren't going to say what they really believed. They did not believe it was from heaven, the baptism of John. But they weren't going to admit that. Why? Because they weren't going to lie and say, "Oh, we believe it's from heaven." That would have been a bold-faced lie, but they didn't say that. They weren't willing to do that because they said, if we say that, then what's he going to say? Why didn't you believe him? I mean, if you really believed that his baptism was from heaven, then why hadn't you accepted that, and why hadn't you obeyed it? So they weren't going to take that position. The other position, the honest one, would have been if they had said, "We believe it's of men." But what was the reason that they didn't say that? Yes, all the people thought it was a prophet. They feared the people. That's that same week. So they have to somehow, in that same week where they're afraid of these people because they all the people hold John to be a prophet, and John's the one that was preparing the way for Jesus himself, and they need the people on their side. And by the end of that same week, those people are there in mass on that day saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." It's astonishing. That could not have happened if it wasn't the Lord's will. And what ends up happening 7 weeks later on the day of Pentecost? How many of those same people were really back to where they were and recognized their error in having been? And this is the whole problem, because it says in Matthew 27 and verse 20 that that those Jewish leaders persuaded the multitude. And that's that word, patho. They convinced them by their arguments. They really, at least for that period of time, of course the devil's behind it, but they talked them, those people, out of what they had already been convinced of and persuaded of by the miracles they had seen, that the Father was bearing witness to Christ, that he had sent him, and And they had believed that. Well, here come, and then you think of it, how could these Jewish leaders, in the space of just a few days, convince all this mass of people to not believe what they had believed there, to then agree that this man needs to be crucified? And then 7 weeks later, they recognize that, and they're pricked in their heart, and they repent of it. Something big was going on there, wasn't it? It was God's will that all of that happened. That was not an ordinary, I don't see that as an ordinary thing at all for that the people as a whole to go in mass after that lie. But they did, and that was the word that's used there, patho, in Matthew 27, verse 20, how they persuaded the multitude. They convinced them by argument. Were those good arguments or bad ones? They got convinced by some bad arguments to believe what was a lie or a pack of lies. But how many people do that? We can, that same word is used, by the way, in Luke 18, verse 9, when Jesus was, when he taught about that Pharisee that went up to pray, and that was for the point of those that he was warning the people of those who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. That word trusted, patho. They were convinced by argument that they were righteous. Well, who was presenting the arguments to them? You know what? You're really righteous. Okay, yeah, I'm convinced. I am. I mean, that's what was going on with them. And how many people are convinced of their righteousness? Just about everybody. And so how good does the argument have to be to convince somebody with that argument that they're great? Doesn't seem like it has to be a very good argument, but because how many people are convinced by it? But I mean, who's really the one presenting the arguments to us that we're right? Who's convincing us of that, or trying to? It's the devil. Because if he can convince us that we're right when we're wrong, he's got us, doesn't he? Because then if we think wrong is right, and what the wrong things that we're doing are really right and okay, then why do we need to change anything? And we can just sail right along on that road, convinced of all these lies, and coast right on into hell. But that's what just about everybody does, isn't it? Well, these ones, they were convinced. They trusted in themselves that they were righteous. They were convinced by argument that they were righteous. I don't think it took much. But Jesus was trying to unconvince them, or at least convince the people by argument that was wrong. But anyway, that we have lots of examples where we can see that arguments are lies that people can be convinced by. And Romans chapter 2, verse 8, when he's talking about those who are going to end up in hell, he says they obey unrighteousness. Well, there's the word, patho is translated obey there, just like it is here in James 3, verse 3. But that's the word patho, to be convinced by argument. But again, he says, oh, they obey unrighteousness. So they're convinced by argument that unrighteousness is what? Is good. Look at the world. What's going on right now in the world that we're in? Did you hear the news? I think it was this morning. Ashar texted me because the Cambridge English Dictionary came up with a new definition for man and woman. So they've redefined it. It's no longer what it used to be, very obviously, what was either a man or a woman. Now it includes, if you identify as a man or a woman, whether you actually are or not. So the definition has been changed. So how many people have been convinced by argument that all this foolishness and wickedness is okay and good and right. And look at the pack of lies that the devil is selling to the world right now. Now, from our perspective, does that look very convincing to you? That a man is actually a woman, or a woman is actually a man? Does that argument, at least, I mean, from my standpoint, that doesn't seem very convincing at all. But that's only if we are blessed with understanding from God that we can see that. But look at how deceived people are, that they're convinced by these horrible-looking arguments, all these lies, that they're going to believe that. Look at how many people actually believe in this now. And we could go on and on with that, the things that are going on in our world today. But that's what God said in Romans 2 and verse 8. That's who's going to end up facing eternal condemnation. All these people who obey unrighteousness, that are convinced by argument of unrighteousness. Obviously, that what is unrighteous is right. Believing the wrong things, believing the lies. Well, there's your strong delusion. I mean, that's what that is. So, Galatians 3, verse 1, and Galatians 5, verse 7, two times he is. Who was the one that had convinced these Galatians to not obey the truth? And that's what both of those verses there. And that's the same word, patho. I mean, Paul's asking, who's convinced you by argument to against the truth? Because as he starts that the book of Galatians, in chapter 1, he said, I marvel that you're so soon removed from him that has called you unto another gospel, which is not another. He was marveling at how soon they were convinced by argument against that very truth that they had believed such a short while ago. Now that should get our attention, because, I mean, it's being, okay, you're convinced by the arguments of truth from God's word, and then all of a sudden, very quickly, you're unconvinced of that, now convinced by the devil's lies against that very truth that you were convinced of just a short time ago. That happened, just like we saw in Mass. That happened in that week in which Christ ended up being crucified. But that happened in Galatia to the brethren there. So if we think, well, no, I'm convinced by God's arguments in his word, so it's done. I can't be convinced by the devil's lies. Well, then we're already being convinced of a lie if we think that. And what can happen? If we're not constantly listening, how many times do we need to hear God's arguments of his truth? Not just one time. We've got to keep hearing it over and over again so it continues to convince us, because if otherwise, the devil's sure not going to let us get away with not hearing his arguments. He's going to present them all, everywhere we go. Now, if we're not hearing the Lord's arguments, that's because we've chosen to tune him out. And we can do that. But we're going to be hearing the devil's arguments over and over and over again. Well, we need that constant reminder from God's word to hear his arguments to convince us continually, to keep us from being unconvinced of his truth, to be convinced by the devil's lies. So if we're not studying his word on our own together as much as possible every day, then what's liable to happen? That for us to end up being convinced of error. Over and over again in the book of Acts, when he's describing the Apostle Paul's work and various places on the missionary journeys that he went, that it will speak about how he persuaded them. Of course, he wasn't convincing them by his own arguments, when Paul was persuading the Jews and Greeks and in the places that he went where he was preaching, who was really persuading them and whose arguments were they? It was God's. Now, did Paul have a special gift of persuasion? No. He had a dedication to a love of God and a zeal for his truth, that he wanted to preach that truth. He wanted the Lord's arguments heard by everybody everywhere. But wherever he went, when he opened his mouth, he didn't give his own arguments, he gave God's. That's all we can do, isn't it? Now, as far as the convincing that occurred in so many places, I mean, who gave that understanding? That had to be from God. And it's the only explanation as to why, for example, when it speaks of Paul, his work in Rome in Acts 28, verses 23 and 24, and it says he was persuading them in verse 3. He was attempting to convince them by argument. Patho is used there. And then it says some believed in the next verse. Well, everybody heard the same arguments. Some were convinced by those arguments, but not everybody. In fact, not the majority, we can discern from that. So what was the difference? I mean, what was in their hearts? That's the same word that was used by Agrippa in Acts 26:28, where we get that excellent song, Almost Persuaded, Patho. That's the word that's there. And Agrippa said, Paul, almost persuadest thou me to be a Christian. I'm almost convinced by your arguments. He was given those arguments as a witness to the resurrection of the dead, or the resurrection of Christ from the dead. He's hearing all of that, and he says, I'm almost convinced by these arguments to be a Christian. Did Paul then say, okay, now, since you're almost convinced by those, I've got the really big argument now that this is going to take you the rest of the way there. I mean, was there any, did he have anything else left? Were there any other arguments to give? Or had he heard enough of the arguments, the truth, to be where he was responsible for being convinced by that? And, I mean, it's sad that he said, I'm almost convinced. But was he? What happens when you are convinced? What do you do? Is there a set, if you're really convinced of an argument, are you going to follow through on it? In my other vocation, I have to try to convince by argument, okay, here's the medical condition you have, and you need to take this treatment, this medicine or whatever. And if somebody said, well, yeah, doc, I'm convinced you're right. I do have that, and this is the right treatment. I need to take that pill, but I'm just not going to do it. I mean, are they convinced? I mean, if you're really, and I've had to deal with that. But anyway, if you are convinced by argument of something, are you going to do anything? If you're really convinced by the argument? I mean, if the argument is designed to bring forth action on your part, if you're convinced by that, and the Lord's arguments are designed to bring forth action, so are the devil's. Either to do righteousness or to do unrighteousness, one or the other. The arguments of both God and the devil are designed to bring about action. If we're convinced by argument, are we going to take action consistent with whatever we're convinced of? Or are we going to say, well, yes, I'm convinced. I'm convinced by those arguments, but I'm not going to do it. Are we really convinced then? No. That's the reason why in James 2, verses 14 through 26, this is why this is the basis of the word faith, and why he says faith without works is dead. I mean, that's really not being convinced. The devils believe. Well, do they know the argument presented to them that there is a God? Are they convinced by that? They know. And they know that Jesus is God's son. They're convinced of that. But are they really convinced by it, with what that means? That there is a God who has all authority that we belong to and that we must serve? No, they tremble because they will not obey him. Are they really convinced, or is that a dead faith? And if we don't obey the Lord, then do we really believe? Are we really convinced? So if we really believe, by definition, we're going to follow through and obey him. So in James 3, verse 3, with the bits in the horses' mouths, we put them there that they may obey us. Well, that is that the word is that they may be convinced by argument, but he says, and we turn about the whole body. So there is obedience involved, even though that the word obedience isn't the one, the word there. But this is a wonderful example showing the link between faith, that conviction, being convinced, persuaded by argument, and then action, works being done from that conviction, from that belief. I mean, the horse is convinced by the argument from that the tugging on the rein that the horse should go over there, but the horse isn't, well, I'm convinced I need to turn that way, otherwise it's going to hurt, but I'm still going to hurt, and I'm not going to go that way. Does that make any sense? Would that make any sense to say that the horse is convinced to go that direction, but then doesn't go there? It makes no more sense to say that we believe God and we believe his word, but then we don't do it. I mean, that's the same, and this fits in the same category. So that James 3, verse 3 is a great one if we can dig down into the words and see the application. It's a powerful demonstration of the link that can't even be separated between faith and obedience. The horse obeys that because he's convinced. He has the faith. He believes that bits and that bridle is to be listened to and followed. All right, but what about our tongues? I mean, the point here really is showing how it's this small thing has full control over something very large. Well, there's the argument of the horse in verse 3 that should convince us. Now we're getting the argument of the ships in verse 4. So he starts again, behold, also the ships, which though they be so great and are driven of fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. I'm not really a ship guy either. I mean, I've been on a few boats, though. And we used to, when I was, we had a pontoon boat for a while, that I used to drive around Lake Murray. When I was in my late teen years around then. But, I mean, it still fit. I mean, the pontoon boat isn't a great, huge, it's not a big ship or anything. But still, compared to the size of that thing, what I had to do to turn that boat to drive it was small. I mean, it's really the same with our cars. That analogy still works there. But what if, I mean, you see those really big ships. I mean, does it take a really massive steering wheel to turn a really big ship? Is that proportional? I mean, the bigger the ship, the bigger the steer. I mean, you got to have like those big container ships. They have like a massive wheel that where it might take more than one person to be able to turn the thing. No, even those huge vessels. I mean, they've got a small wheel that'll turn that big old huge ship. So that's pressing forward the analogy there. Something very, very large controlled by something very, very small. And what's the point with the horses and the ships there? What is he comparing that to? Our little tongues and how much control it has over us. So verse 5, he says, even so, the tongue is a is a little member. Well, in terms of its size, yes, it is. And so it's very small. Micros is the Greek word there. Does that sound kind of familiar? I mean, when we talk about something, what do you call that thing you look through to see something really small that you can't see with your, is too small for us to see with our naked eyes? What do we use? A microscope. We know that word, that prefix micro, it's small. Micros is the word here when he talks about our tongues. Compared to the rest of it, I mean, our tongues are a little micro member. I mean, that's literally what it's saying. So it's very small. I mean, think of the other, I mean, our limbs that we have, and how is the tongue compared size-wise to that? It's astonishing how small our tongue actually is. But he says it boasts great things. That boasts great things is a one word, compound word, but it does mean great boasting. I mean, that's the literal meaning of the word there. How much noise do we make with that little small tongue? A lot. And then he's using that word for a negative way that the tongue is used. And how often are tongues used in a boastful way? Regularly. And how often are people talking about things they've done where they're really lifting themselves up and putting themselves in to show everyone how good they are, how talented they are, what great accomplishment they've done. I mean, how much boasting is done? And we make things that we may not even recognize as boasting, like in the next chapter, in James chapter 4, he says in verse 16, "But now you rejoice in your boasting. All such rejoicing is evil." What boastings is he talking about? Well, that's right after verses 13 through 15, where he said, "Go to now you that say, today or tomorrow we will go into such a city and continue there a year and buy and sell and get gain, whereas you know not what shall be on the morrow. For what is your life? It is even a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. For that you ought to say, if the Lord will, we shall live and do this or that." For us to say that we can go, "I'm going to go here tomorrow," when we're not saying, "If the Lord wills, there will be a tomorrow. I'll be alive and participate in that tomorrow. And if the Lord wills, I will do whatever it is that I do." For us not to say that, for me to say, "I'm going to do that," what is that? That is a boast, and that's the word he says there. We're boasting if we're saying "I," and that we're not saying "if the Lord wills," because it's only if the Lord wills that we'll live or be able to do anything. Who gets the credit for our being alive or going anywhere or doing anything? It's God. And if we leave him out of that and we say "I," and we leave him out, then what are we saying about ourselves? "I've got the power to make myself alive. I've got the power to go in." And that's one of those irritating words that have come along in modern times. You hear it. People talk about empowerment. I never heard that word growing up, when you need to be empowered to do this. And it's people try to boast themselves up and saying, "I'm empowered." Well, what does that mean? What's that saying? We've got the power to do something. Do we? What power do we have? What can we do on our own? I mean, did we make ourselves alive to begin with? And did we give ourselves life? And I mean, we're living because, you know, without getting down the very, you can get down to the microbiological level with what goes on actually in life, with physiology and all that, what's going on in our bodies so that we can actually live from one second to the next. I mean, how many of us actually even know what all that stuff is and how what's actually happening there, and what in the world can we do to continue to make that happen? Can I will myself to be able to be alive for another moment? Nobody can. Do I have that power? No. So if we all make it, we all got here tonight, was it because we're great drivers? My wife is shaking her head a little bit too vigorously there. She's talking about me. It's not because of that. It's not because of our own skill or power or anything else, is it? I mean, who got us here? It is the Lord's will for us to be here tonight to do what we're doing. And He made that happen. And if the Lord wills, we'll all make it home safely. We need to think in those terms, speak in those terms. If we're talking any other way, then we're boasting. And so our tongue is a little member, but it boasts great things. Just even that. We have to train ourselves to think and speak properly so we're not boasting. How many people are boasting just in a moment-to-moment basis saying, yeah, tomorrow I'm going to do this, or... I mean, people with the work schedules, okay, you're going to be working this shift next week, or you're going to be doing... How do they know? Really? You're not going to hear people... You're not going to be hearing managers talk about, well, if the Lord wills, then who's going to be doing this, and... You know, we go over assignments and things like that, but, well, as a Christian, how should we speak? We need to give credit where it belongs. Otherwise, we're boasting. So we need to think about that, and there's a lot more to be that the Lord's going to teach on that subject. But He finishes verse 5, and we'll try to delve into that a little bit more. But the last, and there's, so we have three analogies given in verses 3, 4, and 5. The horses in verse 3, the ships in verse 4. In verse 5, He says, behold, how great a matter a little fire kindleth. That word matter there is really a word for a forest. A big forest, a little fire kindled. We hear every year, I mean, there's wildfires, especially out in the western part of the country. And how many acres, thousands of acres and square miles that can be consumed in a giant forest fire. But how did it start? I mean, it started as a little, sometimes, I mean, very often, it's somebody didn't get their campfire put all the way out. Can you end up with a raging forest fire that covers, I mean, hundreds of square miles just from a spark from a campfire that didn't get put all the way out? Absolutely. What about a lightning bolt that strikes, hits a dry spot and makes a spark, and some of that stuff on the ground will catch fire? I mean, they start with something small, but then what happens? So it's the third analogy that He gives there, or illustration, showing something that is very small that has great power. And then, of course, He's showing the destructive power in verse 5 that goes along with the first part of the verse. So the first two, I mean, those are kind of nice. Yeah, you can steer a horse and you can steer a big ship. But now look at the other side. Look at how much destruction can be caused by that little thing. How destructive it can be. That's why He says in the verse 6 is going to say, and the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So He's going to show the great destructive force that's there. So really verses 3 and 4 drive home the point from verse 2 that our tongue is small, but it is very powerful and can control control us entirely. So if we can bridle it, we can bridle the rest of us. But look at how much damage when it's not bridled and how much destruction it can cause. All right, Lord willing, we'll continue with that next week. If the Lord wills and gives us that opportunity, as we would ask him to do, and we'll that will be the plan if he wills.